Good evening. My name is David McKnight, and I'm the director of UPenn's Rare Book and Manuscript Library. On behalf of the Vice Provost and Director of Libraries, Carton Rogers, it is my honor and pleasure to welcome you to the 80th annual ASW Rosenbach Lectures in Bibliography. As many of you know, the Rare Book and Manuscript Library is closed for renovations, and this fact explains why we are in Claudia Cohen Hall this evening. We will assemble here tomorrow evening for the second lecture. However, due to scheduling complications, the third and final lecture will take place in the Class of 55 lecture room, which is located in the second floor of the Van Pelt-Dietrich Library Center, just across the green. My sincere apologies for the inconvenience, but it is my hope that we'll host the 2013 lectures in the new Special Collection Centers being constructed on the sixth floor of the Van Pelt-Dietrich Library. The Rosenbach Fellowship in Bibliography, established by the trustees of the University of Pennsylvania in 1928, honors a gift for that purpose from Philadelphia native A.S.W. Rosenbach, one of America's greatest book dealers and collectors. Its intention is to further scholarship and scholarly publication in bibliography and book history broadly understood. Christopher Morley delivered the first Rosenbach lecture in 1931. Thanks to the generosity of Rosie Rosenbach, the University of Pennsylvania Libraries will be able to offer the lecture series long into the future. I speak with optimism because I believe, despite the marketing of e-books and e-readers and the plaintive ringing of the death knell for the book, that human communication itself, as represented in its material forms, will continue to excite a passion for understanding the past, stimulate the collecting impulse, both private and institutional, generate public interest, and arouse scholarly inquiry, thus enabling the Rosenbach Committee, Lecture Committee, to bring to Penn's campus leading scholars in the field of bibliography and book history to share their research with you, the audience. At this time, I would like to acknowledge and thank my fellow members of the Rosenbach Lecture Organizing Committee, which includes Jerry Singerman, senior editor of the Humanities at the University of Pennsylvania Press, Peter Stolle Press, Walter and H. Lenore, C. Annenberg Professor in the Humanities and Professor of English and of Comparative Literature and Literary Theory, representing the Rare Book and Manuscript Library, Dr. Dan Traister. Dan is here somewhere. There he is. Curator for Research Services, and Mr. John Pollock, Rare Book Specialist. Where are you, John? John, there you are. You know the lights. Approximately 6 years ago, the UPenn Press and the Rare Book and Manuscript Library entered into a fruitful partnership to select speakers for the Rosenbach Lectures. While we collectively fuss and mull over potential speakers, we have divided the labors as follows. The library sponsors and hosts the lecture series, and the press engages with the speaker as author in terms of negotiating the publication of the lectures in book form. The press has the right of first refusal. Although we have lectures lined up through to March 2014, the committee recently met, and I'm pleased to report that we are faced with a daunting list of remarkable potential speakers to choose from for 2015 and beyond. I would like to point out that the press does have on hand books for sale, and you'll see them on display outside where the reception will be held. Among the titles on display include the last year's Rosenbach lecturer, Elizabeth Eisenstein's latest book, Divine Art, Infernal Machine, The Reception of Printing in the West, From First Impressions to the Sense of an Ending. Before introducing our speaker, I would like to take a further moment to thank, first and foremost, Alita Arthurs and her staff for organizing the event and our speaker's travel and accommodations. Secondly, I would like to thank Andrea Gottschalk for the preparation and design of graphic materials to promote and advertise the lecture series. Thirdly, I would like to thank Lloyd Frank, who's at the back, one of our colleagues in the music library, for recording the lecture series. Finally, I would like to invite you to stay after this evening's lecture for the library-hosted reception honoring the 2011 ASW Rosenbach Lecturer. As a fellow Canadian citizen, we joked about this morning, I'm delighted that Alberto is here this evening. I did not have an opportunity to see Alberto when he was in Canada in various venues. And I looked hard and fast for a Canadian joke, but alas, you are spared. Born in Buenos Aires in 1948, Alberto Manguel grew up in Tel Aviv, where his father served as the first Argentinian ambassador to Israel. After receiving his degree from the Colegio Nacional de Buenos Aires in 1968, he left Argentina for Europe. In the 1970s, Manguel lived a peripatetic life in France, England, Italy, and Tahiti, reviewing, translating, editing, and always reading. In 1983, Manguel moved to Toronto, Canada, where he lived and worked for almost 20 years. In 2000, Manguel purchased and renovated a medieval presbytery in the Poitou-Charentes region of France, where he currently resides. He has received many prizes, was awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship and an honorary doctorate from the University of Liège. He is an officier de l'Ordre des Arts et Lettres in France. Manguel is the author of 5 works of fiction, 18 works of nonfiction, and he is the editor of 24 anthologies. In 1995-96, Manguel's A History of Reading was published to wide acclaim. I mentioned 95 because my Canadian imprint of that volume is 1995. History of Reading was published to wide acclaim. He has continued to explore the theme of reading in such works as Reading Pictures, published in 2000, The City of Words, 2007, which were, by the way, the Massey Lectures, a distinguished Massey series, a lecture series in Canada, and The Library at Night, published in 2008. As Alberto has documented in his marvelous 1995 study, A History of Reading, the act of reading takes many forms and shapes, nor is the subject of reading foreign to the Rosenbach Lectures. In 1974, Bernard Fabian lectured on literacy and the reading public in the 18th century. Reading was the theme of lectures in 1996 and 1999, which were given respectively by Janice Radway and Brian Stock. The title of Alberto Manguel's Rosenbach lectures in bibliography is The Traveler, the Tower, and the Worm. Please join me in welcoming Alberto Manguel.
Thank you. Well, I'm of course very honored to have been asked to give the Rosenbach Lectures this year. Previous lecturers belong to my library. I have read them for many years and learned much from them. I think I understand what Oscar Wilde meant when he said that he felt a lion in a cage full of Daniels. That's how I feel right now. My first lecture is called The Reader's Traveler. In these 3 lectures, I'm going to be looking at different metaphors that we use to name the reader and ask a few questions about why those metaphors and what they tell us about the society that uses them. As far as we can tell, we are the only species for whom the world seems to be made of stories. Biologically developed to be conscious of our existence, we treat our perceived identities and the identity of the world as if they required a literate decipherment, as if everything in the universe were represented in a code that we are supposed to learn and understand. Human societies are based on this assumption that we are, up to a point, capable of understanding the world in which we live. To understand the world, or to try and understand it, translation of experience into language is not enough. Language barely glances the surface of our experience and transmits from one person to another in a supposedly shared conventional code, imperfect and ambiguous notations that rely both on the careful intelligence of the one who speaks or writes and on the creative intelligence of the one who listens or reads. To enhance the possibilities of mutual understanding and to create a larger space of meaning, language resorts to metaphors, which are ultimately a confession of language's failure to communicate directly. Through metaphors, experiences in one field become illuminated by experiences in another. Literate societies, societies based on the written word, have developed a central metaphor to name the perceived relationship between human beings and their universe, the world as book, which we are meant to read. The ways in which this reading is conducted are many, through fiction, mathematics, cartography, biology, geology, poetry, theology, and myriad others. But their basic assumption is the same, that the universe is a coherent system of signs governed by specific laws, and that those signs have a meaning, even if that meaning lies beyond our grasp, and that in order to glimpse that meaning, we try to read the book of the world. Now, to read is to travel. We advance through a text as we advance down an open road, passing from the first page to the last through the unfolding landscape, sometimes starting in mid-chapter, sometimes not reaching the end. The intellectual experience of crossing the pages as we read becomes a physical experience, calling into action the entire body, hands turning the pages or fingers scrolling the text, legs lending support to the receptive body, eyes scanning for meaning, ears tuned to the sound of the words in our head. The pages in front of us promise a point of arrival. The pages already read promise the possibility of recollection. And in the present of the text, we exist suspended in a moment that constantly changes, a time that wavers between that of the text known and that of the text yet to come. Every reader is an armchair traveler. It was Saint Augustine who most clearly understood the relationship between the act of reading and the all-too-swift passing through life. "Suppose I'm going to recite a psalm I know," he suggests in the Confessions. "Before I begin, my faculty of expectation is engaged by the whole of it. But once I have begun, as much of the psalm as I have removed from the province of my expectation and relegated to the past, now engages my memory, and the scope of the action which I am performing is divided between the two faculties of memory and expectation, the one looking back to the part which I have already recited, the other looking forward to the part which I still have to recite. But my faculty of attention is present all the while, and through it passes what was the future in the process of becoming the past. As the process continues, the province of memory is extended in proportion as that of expectation is reduced, until the whole of my expectation is absorbed. This happens when I have finished my recitation and it has passed into the province of memory." For Augustine, the act of reading is a journey through the text being read, claiming for the province of memory the territory explored, while in the process the uncharted landscape ahead gradually diminishes and becomes familiar territory. "What is true of the psalm," Augustine continues, "is also true of all its parts and of each syllable. It is true of any longer action in which I may be engaged, and of which the recitation of the psalm may be only a small part. It is true of a man's whole life, of which all his actions are parts. It is true of the whole history of humankind, of which each life is a part." For Augustine, the experience of reading and the experience of journeying through life mirror one another. By the time Augustine was writing his Confessions, the idea of the reader as traveler was already very ancient, though Augustine could not have known it. The traveling reader appears in one of our oldest narratives, the Epic of Gilgamesh, first written around 1750 BC, refined and reassembled some two centuries later. The revised composition, known as the Ninevite version, was found inscribed in 11 clay tablets. And in the first verses of the first tablet, the poet presents his hero, the great king Gilgamesh, and the marvel he built, the fortified city of Uruk. And then the poet addresses the reader. "Look at these walls, tight as a net for birds. Consider the base, how incomparable. Feel this slab of the threshold brought from far away. Advance towards the temple, the house of Ishtar that no other king, no one else was able to imitate. Climb up and stroll on Uruk's ramparts. Inspect the foundations, observe the lines of brick. Are they not indeed hand-baked? And did not the seven sages themselves lay the base? 300 hectares of city and as many of gardens and as many of virgin soil belong to the temple. Behold, in these 1,000 hectares you see all of Uruk. Go now and seek the copper casket, turn the bronze ring, open the secret compartment, and pull out the lapis lazuli tablets in order to read how Gilgamesh went through his many trials." The poet apostrophizes the reader, urging him to look, consider, feel, advance, climb, stroll, inspect, seek, open, pull out, and read. In a vertiginous, self-perpetuating circle, the reader is told to travel through the city of which he's reading in order to discover a text, the one he now holds in his hands, that will tell him to accomplish a series of tasks that will allow him to learn about King Gilgamesh's adventures. Talk about postmodernism. As we begin to read, we are already obeying the poet's injunction. We are already part of the poem. From the first words of the first tablet, we, the readers, become Gilgamesh's traveling companions. And yet, our role is, of course, not precisely the same as that of Gilgamesh, nor that of his chronicler poet. Gilgamesh, we are told from the start, has long completed his earthly journey. And the poet, as the 11 tablets prove, has long composed the final words of the chronicle. We, however, have yet to set off, but with the advantage of having been given both the route and the final destination. From Gilgamesh onwards, it can be said that if we readers are travelers, we are not pioneers. The path we take has been trodden before, and the maps of the country, though susceptible to change, have been drawn. Michel de Certeau compared the text through which we travel to the writer's hunting grounds on which the reader is a poacher. Well, whether poaching in the forest of Arden or fishing in the dolphin-torn sea, whether wandering through unreal cities or entering undiscovered countries, whether trying to reach the shores of Ithaca or lighting out for the territory, whether discovering ice for the first time or being promised an ever-postponed excursion to the lighthouse, our reading routes are signposted and a guide, either reliable or not, is always at hand. Some 3,000 years after Gilgamesh, Dante tells us that he found himself in a dark forest halfway along the road of life. Here begins what is perhaps the most famous travel narrative in Western literature, one that will take us, Dante's readers, through three otherworldly realms, which, by means of Dante's words, have acquired a permanent and tangible geography in our imagination. In societies with roots in Christianity, to speak of hell, purgatory, and paradise is to make use, consciously or not, of Dante's logbook. Beginning with a dark forest where the straight path is lost, The reader follows Dante down into the circles of hell and up through the terraces of purgatory and across the heavens of paradise. To think back on that wild, rough, dense wood, Dante tells us, renews in his mind the fear that he then felt, a fear that the reader is now compelled to feel as well. And yet, however hard the task, Dante knows that he must tell of the things he saw for the sake of the good he there discovered. Implicit in this declared intent is a gift to the reader. It is for us that Dante will force himself to return to the scene of his perilous travels. "You had best undertake another journey," says Virgil to Dante at their first encounter. Virgil offers Dante a journey that is not the one Dante intended, straight from the dark forest to the top of the Blessed Mountain, but one through the realms of the afterlife, first seeing and suffering with his body, and then with his mind through his poetry. And as in the case of Gilgamesh, from the first words of the first canto, we, the readers of that poetry, become Dante's fellow travelers. Here, too, our role as travelers differs both from those of the pilgrim and the poet. Nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita, we understand that these first words are the starting point of the narrative. But this is only true in a literal sense. The journey itself started much earlier. The beginning we're given to read is already halfway along the road of our life. It is only at this middle point that we're invited to join the traveler, after a lengthy stretch has already been covered, well before the book's opening, through landscapes and episodes of the poet's early life, which Dante has chosen not to chronicle in the Commedia. We begin traveling in what medieval rhetoric formalized as in media res. In one other important sense, we are deprived of an actual beginning. The action of "mi ritrovai per una selva oscura," I found myself in a dark forest, has already taken place long ago in Dante's past. The adventures are now over. The terror and the surprise are distant memories. The repentance and the revelation have already happened. And the pilgrim has returned to earth, ready to bear witness. In medieval terms, pilgrimage implies a journey to the shrine and back, not a one-way passage. Though the voyage was dangerous, the realms uncharted, the outcome unforeseen, all has now been resolved, the goal has been reached, and the return home safely effected. And all this is implied in those very first words of the poem. As the reader knows, for the poem to exist, the pilgrim must have survived, like the messengers in Job, to tell the story. As readers of Dante's poem, we are therefore privileged witnesses. From the very start, we are promised a happy outcome, since that is the meaning of the title Commedia, a story that ends happily. We know that by the end of Paradiso's last canto, the pilgrim will have reached his destination and will be ready to return home, that he has indeed returned home to give an account of himself on paper. However, unlike his readers, we are more or less aware of what will happen in the story even before the first page. Dante the pilgrim, lost in the dark forest, knows nothing of what awaits him, nothing of the three dreadful beasts that will bar his path, nothing of the ghostly presence that will reveal itself as his appointed guide, nothing of the abominable and blissful souls ahead, nothing of the ultimate and ineffable bliss with which his prodigious travels will be rewarded. And yet, knowing all this and having such an advantage, will we, the readers, be equal to the task? Will we be able to become worthy travel companions of so extraordinary an adventurer? To accomplish his journey, as we know, Dante the man has become Dante the pilgrim, who in turn has become Dante the poet, the chronicler of his adventures. And we, accepting the role now assigned to us, must in turn lose our ordinary identity and become pilgrims ourselves, transformed through the act of reading into necessary characters in the story, addressed by Dante over and over again to warn us, guide us, instruct us, beseech us to reflect and do our enlightened best. Every path leading to spiritual realization, wrote the art historian Titus Burckhardt, demands from whoever undertakes it the stripping of the habitual I in order to become truly oneself, a transformation that is accompanied by the sacrifice of apparent riches and vain pretensions, that is to say, by the sacrifice of humiliation, of the struggle against the passions of which the old I is made. And that is certainly the case of Dante the pilgrim, and it is also true of the reader. In order to follow Dante, we must strip ourselves of our everyday identity. We must leave aside the comforts of common sense and familiar references. We must sacrifice our solid and reassuring notions of factual reality. And we must humbly submit to the rules and resolutions set down by the poet for our guidance. Dante is very aware of our difficulties in this respect, and as he is about to enter the first heaven, guided by the terrible smile of Beatrice, he speaks to the readers in warning terms. O you who in your little boat, longing to hear, have followed on my keel that sings along the way, turn to see again your own home shores. Don't enter the open sea, or well you might by losing sight of me be lost yourselves. E. R. Curtius, in his fundamental study of the persistence of classical imagery in European literature, noted that many were the Latin poets who compared the craft of writing to that of sailing, Propertius, Manilius, Horace, and Statius, among several others. Vela dare to set sail, says Virgil in the second book of the Georgics, and towards the end, in the fourth, he speaks of vela traere, to bring the sails down. This circular motion, beginning and ending the act of sailing forth, is essential to the idea of traveling through a text. Travel narratives, factual or allegorical, have this in common. They carry implicit their conclusion, and their point of departure assumes a point of arrival. Every travel narrative declares that in my end is my beginning, since once having arrived, the traveler will begin the voyage again by telling his adventures. In fact, the very purpose of Dante's pilgrimage is to begin again, this time not with fearful steps, but with fiery words. She who for our sake left her footprints in hell, says Dante of Beatrice, but the same can be said of Dante by his readers. The voyage was made for us, for the sake of the story. Dante's story, then, is both a landscape and a map, or rather a series of landscapes whose map is created as the traveler advances through it, walking or climbing, flying on the back of a monster, or being rowed across hellish waters, guided by Virgil up Mount Purgatory, or transported timelessly through the heavens by Beatrice. So precise, so vivid, so cartographically exact are Dante's descriptions of the realms he crosses that the 24-year-old Galileo, not the least empirical of men, was able to deliver in 1588 two scientific lectures on the situation and size of Dante's hell. for Galileo, as for Dante, the imaginary world, just like the physical world itself, can be mapped and explored by the reader. The book is a world through which we can travel because the world is a book that we can read. The idea of the world as book is an ancient one. In the book of Ezekiel, the prophet sees the heavens open and a hand appears holding a book roll spread out before him, written within and without, and there was written therein lamentations and mourning and woe. The image is picked up, of course, in the book of Revelation and gives rise to an extensive library of biblical commentaries that throughout the Middle Ages and the Renaissance see in this double book the image of God's creation, both in Scripture and in earth, both of which we are meant to read and in both of which we are written. Talmudic commentators associated the double book to the double tablets of the Torah. According to the Midrash, the Torah God gave Moses on Mount Sinai was a written text as well as an oral commentary. During the day, when it was light, Moses read the text God had written in the tablets. In the darkness of the night, he studied the commentary God has spoken when he created the world. For the Talmudists, the book of nature is understood as God's oral gloss on his own written text. For Saint Bonaventure, writing in the 13th century, Ezekiel's book is both the word and the world. God, says Bonaventure, created this perceptible world as a means of self-revelation, so that like a mirror of God or a divine footprint, it might lead man to love and praise his Creator. Accordingly, there are two books, one written within, and that is inscribed by God's eternal art and wisdom, the other written without, and that is the perceptible world. By the 17th century, the trope had become so ingrained in Western imagination that it could be once more be taken up and rephrased. In Religio Medici, Sir Thomas Browne made the commonplace image his own. Thus, there are two books from whence I collect my divinity, besides that written one of God, another of his servant nature, that universal and public manuscript that lies expansed unto the eyes of all. Those who never saw him in the one have discovered him in the other. Certainly for Dante, one of God's books cannot be read properly without aid of the other. As the pilgrim advances through the three perceptible realms, the poetic or intellectual image of the world as book becomes more and more concrete until it takes on what Dante calls a universal shape. The shape of a book. This anticipates Mallarmé by quite a few centuries. For Dante, reaching the final vision in the Empyrean, the ultimate reality is a book. Dante's pilgrimage is therefore not only an act of material travel, a displacement in space, but one in time, as in Augustine's reading of the Psalm. Unlike the physical traveler who merely follows the path forward, Dante, like a curious and reflective reader, while moving along the road from the first to the last page, allows himself to go back, to retrace, explore territory, to recall, foretell, associate events, past, present, and future, leafing back and forth through God's book, where that which, and I'm quoting, of course, Dante, that which in the universe seems separate and scattered is gathered and bound by love in a single volume. For Dante's contemporaries, the image of the reader as traveler carried by and large an active and positive connotation. Reading was a beneficial labor if directed towards the right goal and performed in the right spirit. allowing the intellect to understand what the spirit intuits through love. In this sense, all human beings were meant to be travelers, which is why, perhaps, in the biblical tradition, God preferred the offerings of the nomadic herdsman Abel to those of the sedentary cropholder Cain, and punished Cain after his crime by forcing him to become a wanderer himself. There are a number of Talmudic commentaries that oppose this, but let me say that I find this one more interesting. But there were many shades to this interpretation. The reader who committed himself to the exploration of a text had the qualities of an adventurer, an explorer, an intrepid seafarer who could either, like Jason, pursue a worthy cause and bring back home the golden fleece, or like Ulysses, pursue a merely reckless goal in a mad flight from which there may be no return, condemning himself to burn throughout eternity in Dante's hell for his audacity. And travel, of course, could also be a punishment, as in the case of the wandering Jew, who in the medieval legend is condemned to wandering the earth till the second coming for having denied Christ rest when he was carrying the cross past the Jew's doorstep. But in its most praiseworthy sense, traveling, like reading, was a pilgrimage that mirrored the pilgrimage of human life. Dante is a pilgrim, Ulysses an explorer, noted a celebrated Dante critic. Dante, glossing one of his own sonnets, explained that pilgrim can be understood in one of two ways, one broad and the other restricted. In a restricted sense, pilgrim only means he who travels from the house of St. James towards the house of St. James, to the sanctuary of St. James of Compostela. Dante, who wrote his Commedia in exile, must have known in what broad sense he was himself a pilgrim. He must have felt the proximity between his itinerant life and his itinerant reading, and known the bitterness, as he says in the Commedia, of eating alien bread tasting like salt and climbing up and down alien stairs. I have wandered like a beggar through virtually all the regions to which this tongue of ours extends, he says in the Convivio, reading his way through Italy. During the 20 long years of exile, until the last day of his life, Dante's library consisted of the few books he dragged with him from one refuge to another, to which were added the ones his hosts would occasionally lend him, a changing collection that reflected the different stages and experiences of the various sites of his banishment. Augustine had noted that reading was a form of travel not of places but of affections. For Dante it was both. Reading was for him the literal exploration of the geography of his elected authors, St. Augustine's Rome and Carthage and the celestial Jerusalem, Statius's Africa, Virgil's Italy, and the otherworldly realms of St. Thomas Aquinas and St. Bonaventure, but also their overlaid cartography of affection and experience. There was perhaps a point towards the end of his life when Dante no longer knew if his Commedia was an intricate map of his life or whether his life was a hesitant sketch of the Commedia. Now, I don't believe that this positive interpretation of reading as traveling is still true today. What has changed for us is less the idea of reading as travel, as the meaning of travel itself. For Dante's contemporaries, travel mirrored precisely the essential act of living. I am a stranger on earth, a passerby like all my ancestors, an exile, an uneasy traveler in this brief life, wrote Petrarch in one of his letters, almost half a century after Dante's journey. We no longer carry that sense of transience within us, at least not in the essential way in which Petrarch and Dante felt it. Almost everything in our societies incites us to believe that we are quasi-immortal beings preserved in an eternal present. Change today is not a passage that builds up the Augustinian province of memory while reducing that of our expectation, but a leap from one electronically ruled moment to another on which the previous ones cast no shadow while the ones to come are never brought to mind. This constant instantaneity allows us to believe that we exist only in the moment, in the circle in which we happen to find ourselves, with no sense of progression or overlapping. It creates for us the illusion of a constant present, flickering behind the screen open before us, so that we can disregard the past in all its manifestations, libraries, archives, the recollections of our elders, our own ability to remember, and dismiss the consequences of our actions. If today reading is a form of travel, it is only in the sense of changing timelessly from place to place, ignoring differences of latitude and longitude, pretending that everything occurs under our gaze, wherever we find ourselves. The act of reading a single line deeply and comprehensively carried for Dante the echo of all our libraries, past, present, and future, each word harping back to Babel and forward to the last trumpet. It meant a constant decipherment, a constant displacement from one acquired experience to the next, a nomadic reading through memory towards desire, conscious of the road traveled and of the road still ahead. Our worldwide reading, precisely because it assumes to be worldwide, seems to require no displacement. Everything, we are told, is always here at the touch of a finger. We don't need to travel towards it because it appears all of a sudden. We don't need to commit it to memory because our electronic memories perform that duty in our name. We don't need to explore and sift through endless volumes because search engines will find our quarries for us. Nor do we need to claim a traveler's freedom and risk in the act of reading. Electronic rules and regulations set strict parameters for us to follow and assume the praise or blame. I'm talking here about the electronic reincarnations of the text, not of the many other uses of the electronic media. The electronic text has done away with the symbolic physical hierarchies of the text. A bound book seeming more prestigious than a paperback more prestigious than a newspaper more prestigious than a comic book, and so on. In the electronic world, a Twitter message sent from Tripoli today can have greater power than a full-length printed book on the state of Libyan politics. So certainly, as a political instrument, as a number of recent instances have proven, the electronic word has served a purpose that no traditional writing pad or pamphlet could have ever served, not even the most virulent ones of the underground press during the Enlightenment or the Samizdat publications in the Soviet Union. In these cases, instantaneity and ubiquity are of the essence, and no instrument up to this day is better suited to a revolutionary purpose than the electronic media. But the reading of an electronic book, of Dante's Commedia Online, for instance, while possessing a uniform worldwide quality and proclaiming the possibilities of unlimited navigation, is in fact far more restricted and controlled than Dante's own codex reading, partly because Dante and his contemporaries were conscious that as readers, They were accompanying the author on a journey that they would enrich with their own experience of other authoritative readings, with no other limitations than those established by the text itself and by their own capabilities. We instead, readers of an electronic text, set off through scrolling panels that erect before us enclosures of writing all identical to each other. We skim down an always present page, surrounded not by spaces left for commentary, but mostly by alienating advertising. And we lack the material sense of physically following the story as we do when we hold a printed volume in our hands. In a recent online publication analyzing the evolution of Google and its effects on the common reader, the French electronics analyst Jean Sarzanat, together with his colleague Alain Pierrot, compared traditional book reading and electronic reading to different forms of travel. With the printed book, the authors wrote, we sail like the Greeks did, with the coast always in sight. The electronic text allows us to pass on to satellite travel and to see the Earth from far, far away. I would say that the contrary is true. Reading a book held in our hands, conscious of its physical characteristics and material presence, we associate freely the page we are reading with other parts of the book and also with other books. We don't merely paste fragments of text together. We reconstruct arguments and characters in our mind. We connect ideas and theories in a vast, horizonless mental space. The solid book of paper and ink is the ground we journey through, a starting point for commentary and conjecture, and for its double, the journal book we develop in our mind. The electronic book, on the other hand, is not grounded. It is, by definition, virtual. And this lack of solidity, this ghostly presence, open to constant cuts, enlargements, and fluctuations, accomplishes only up to a point our traditional mnemonic function. And so it performs the mental traveling we seek. It does it for its own sake, as it were, scrolling on without us needing to be conscious of the progress or take responsibility for it, as I have said. At the same time, while the printed or manuscript page suggests the possibility of endless pages stacked in endless libraries, the screen constantly reminds us of the limits of our reading, of having in front of us, in spite of devices such as windows, one single section of text, an exclusive frame for each separate moment. Electronic reading forces us to return to the method of the Gilgamesh tablets, one page at a time. It is in its very function piecemeal due to the physical constraints of the screen, bound by a site, subject to a program limited to a search by a search engine. But these are not comparisons of value. They are comparisons of nature, of methods, not better or worse, but merely different from one another. Dante, reading far into the main, knew, however, that there was always a first page to which he could unceasingly return. We today, performing first and foremost a technological task of which only one of the byproducts is reading, we today must hug the electronic shore. It may be that in our increasingly gadget-driven society, we may have lost the sense of why we read, as we may have lost the sense of why we travel. Robert Louis Stevenson famously declared that, "For my part, I travel not to go anywhere, but to go. I travel for travel's sake. The great affair is to move." He was deliberately challenging an audience for whom travel had an established destination and also a home to which the traveler might safely return to profit from the experience. Today's travel has no destination, but neither is it possessed by Stevenson's ambition to move. Its purpose is not to move, but to stand still, to remain in the here and now, or what comes to the same, to be almost instantaneously in a place, leaping from side to side, so that there is no passage from one point to another, either in space or in time, much as in our new reading habits. Unfortunately, such methods affect not only travel and reading. They affect our thoughts as well, our reflective capacities, our intellectual muscles. Our thinking functions require not only awareness of ourselves, but awareness of our passage through the world, and awareness of our passage through the pages of a book. This was an ability that we developed after the age of Gilgamesh's tablets, and which we have relinquished in the age of the screen. Now we must once more learn to read slowly, profoundly, comprehensively, to travel in order to return to what we have read. Readers of the printed word are constantly being told that their tools are old-fashioned, their methods outmoded, that they must learn the new technologies or be left behind by the galloping herd. Perhaps. But if we are gregarious animals who must follow the dictates of society, we are nevertheless individuals who learn about the world by reimagining it, by putting words to it, by reenacting through those words our experience. In the end, and here I come to my end, it may be more useful, more interesting, more illuminating to concentrate on that which does not change in our craft, on that which defines the act of reading, on the vocabulary we use to try to understand as self-conscious beings, this unique ability born from the need to survive through imagination and through hope. Thank you.
Questions? Question.
Well, thank you for this very, very elegant, beautiful talk. If I may, I'd like you to ponder and comment for us something else in the Commedia. I mean, you've read the Commedia very persuasively as a voyage and set it out spatially, and yet when Dante reaches the Paradiso and the Celestial Rose, he's in a place that quite affirmatively defies space. Everything is very distant yet very close at the same time, and that sense of space, sense of a voyage collapses for him. And I'd be interested in your thoughts on that and how that does or does not work with the model of the reader as traveler.
Paradise in Dante's structure has no time and has no space. Everything is there at the same time. All the souls have the same bliss, even if they have different degrees of blessedness. And the only reason why Dante has the impression that he goes from heaven to heaven is that Beatrice sets this up for him, because poor man, he wouldn't understand things otherwise. So she invents for him a masquerade. The souls appear with faces, they appear in different heavens, but that is not where they are, because this simultaneity and this instantaneous act of being is not comprehensible to Dante, and even when at the very end he has the vision of everything together, that everything together then becomes ineffable. Jorge Luis Borges, burdened with the Commedia all his life since he first read it in his early 30s, tried to explain this by writing a short story called The Aleph, where someone completely unworthy has the vision of this everything point in the world, and tries to define it. But in defining it, in describing it, Borges produces in the reader that same effect of incomprehensibility, because he says, among other things, here is everything, including, and the list is very, very long, the true story of your death. So we are encapsulated in that time that isn't time and in that space that isn't space. This, as you know from medieval iconography, was an assumption, even though it seems beyond our capacity to understand it. For instance, in the representations of the Annunciation, there is a little crucifix, or there is something that tells the whole story in before the story happens at a given moment. Everything is already there. And this is what Dante tries to put forward for us. And the only way he achieves it is by saying that I can't do it. The end is a confession of failure. But that is a whole other subject, the importance of failure in a great work of art. You can't succeed if it's going to be great.
Hello. One of the parts in your lecture you mentioned was that travel was a punishment as opposed to a reward or part of an adventure. And I guess I hadn't really thought about that before. Is there a part in your experience where maybe it always was punishment up front and it slowly made the shift over to something we'd actually want to do?
Anyone taking a plane today knows.
and that's the other thing that struck me. The title of the lecture is The Reader's Traveler, and it's funny because over the past month I sat in an airport and I looked around and it seems like everybody in an airport reads anymore. They're always doing something. Maybe it's because we're waiting so long for planes or cancellations, I don't know. But it just seems like it's a very intelligent crowd that actually travels because they read so much.
I'm sure that's an illusion. In medieval terms, of course, it becomes both things. It becomes the reward, depending on what the travel is. The travel to a saint's shrine will be rewarded with that return, and it can also be a curse, because you can be cursed as the wandering Jew is cursed with never being able to get anywhere, constant travel. So both elements are there. But that is also true in much of the medieval vocabulary, where every element has what Dante would call its contrapasso, the other side, or what Jung would call the shadow. Whatever you do has that other possibility, the negative possibility.
I just wanted to connect your idea of how we read today, the online reading experience of one block at a time, to the way Dante's first readers experienced the Commedia. I don't know what your take is on John Ahern's argument on the way it circulated as one page at a time, each canto divided into the little canticle, and each one was written front and back on one folio and circulated that way. And he argues that that Dante never actually saw his book fully bound, that image at the end of Paradiso is almost an encouragement for his early readers to go ahead and bind them all together,
He did think that it would be bound, right, if he was encouraging them to do it.
So in a way, his readers really were traveling just one page at a time.
I don't think so. If we look at the illustrated manuscripts of Dante, and from the very beginning there are illustrated manuscripts, we see how much of an idea of sequence, almost a comic book sequence, they have. Things have to be shown as constantly happening. So in one illumination, you will have four or five stages of a certain canto. The practical idea that the Commedia would be copied out, and well, only the Inferno and then part of Purgatorio would be copied out on single sheets, is a way of making the reading accessible to many. But I don't think it is constraining and obligatory as it is now. There is no other form to read a text except a page at a time electronically. You don't have the possibility of starting on page 20 and putting your finger on page 25 and flipping back to page 6 and having a truly interactive reading experience.
In terms of hypertextual editions of Dante.
Yes.
And I've actually played with a few of them, mm-hmm, while writing a paper on readers and Dante. And
I'd love to read it.
It's nowhere near ready for you to look at all.
I'm patient.
But in my research, I encountered accounts of the manuscripts that you're describing, but they're much later manuscripts. The way even Petrarch encountered Dante was still in these lesser type of manuscripts or just bits and pieces. He even talks about the fact that Dante's work is being sung on the streets. It's not high-level literature.
But I think we're talking about many different things here. We are talking about the physical copying of a text that is distributed. We are talking about a reading that is memorized and then sung. And we're also talking about a grounding of a text that becomes important to a society even without reading it, so that people knew about it without having read the book. So the notion that he had gone to hell and certain images of that passage were part then very quickly of the social consciousness. But we're not talking about the same kind of imposition that the electronic text has on us. We're talking about different ways of reading in the Middle Ages through single sheets and sometimes bound volumes, and many times just hearing the story read and learning the story by heart without reading it. And I think you will find that even though Petrarch mentions that form of reading Dante, you will find earlier references to reading the manuscript with the illustrations. And of course, the commentaries, beginning with the Sun's commentary, is much earlier and already alludes to certain illustrations.
All right, we have another question for that.
Yes.
Thank you so much for taking us on the journey of your first lecture. In your account of the history of reading, at least in the West, it seems as if the last great transformative moment in the history of the book, namely the invention of print, is entirely insignificant.
Is entirely insignificant.
That is to say, had no fundamental transformative impact on the practice of reading. I wonder if that is the case, and if so, or if not, whether you would like to say something about that.
The person who should answer that is, of course, Elizabeth Eisenstein. No, of course, every new technology demands a new method of using it, and every new technology applied to the book demands a new method for using it. The printing obviously changed many things. For one, when you would say that you read a certain book and someone else read that book after the invention of printing, you were truly talking about reading the same book, while unless before that you read the same manuscript, you were not reading the same book because of all the many changes that each manuscript or characteristics that each manuscript had. So I won't list here because it's too long a story all the changes that printing brings, but it is important to remember that every new technology brings on certain reading changes, and the electronic technology has brought them as well. I think that what perhaps we need to be more conscious of is up to what point a new technology borrows from the previous one, enriches the previous one, and there is an exchange between the different technologies. Also, that a new technology, even if every time it appears it declares the death of the previous one, it never really means it. The old technology never dies. With the invention of the printing press, the number of manuals of calligraphy boomed. Everybody wanted to write by hand. And writing by hand began to also develop in the printed book, so that handbooks that appeared begin to fill with exercises of handwriting. I think not as a rebellion against the new technology, simply because the appearance of a new technology reminds you of the existence of the previous one. Only recently have there been histories of reading. We read without realizing that we had a history or that there was such a thing as a reader that could be characterized in a certain way. Some of the earlier texts that describe or try to imply that there is a history are from the 20th century. Before that, there is a vague idea of what the reader is doing. So I think that I'm not really answering your question, because it implies answering a whole history of the development of printing. But yes, there were changes in the methods of reading.
I think we have time for one more question, and here is a question.
So in a recent issue of Science, there was a description of the reading by a computer of millions of volumes, and there's an analysis of the first look at what the computer had found by doing that, and there's a sense in which side by side with this electronic reading of one page at a time, you have this massive possibility of, a very different kind of reading. Have you thought about that?
Well, it depends on who does what. Certainly, I haven't read that article, but I can very well imagine that a computer could zoom through a library of a million books and incorporate that into the computer's memory. But unless I am the reader, that is of absolutely no use or significance to me. There is a story by Ray Bradbury, and you'll forgive me if I go back to the reading of my adolescence, called There Will Come Soft Rains. And it is an entirely electronic house that he describes that prepares breakfast and calls for waking up and makes the beds, and in the evening suggests the reading of a poem, and when the inhabitants of the house don't answer, the computer chooses a poem that the computer will read, and so on. The people are dead. There has been a nuclear war, and everybody has been annihilated, but the machine continues to work. And I am afraid that many of these experiences simply indicate that the computer can do it. But once again, we have to assume the responsibility of that. We have to make use of that memory. Seneca speaks of the uselessness of the accumulation of information that is not knowledge. Accumulation of information is not knowledge. The fact that libraries exist in the memories of computers have no significance for me unless I can go to them and find what I want and find them according to a method that is useful to me, a search engine that will find it for me, does not have the same effect on my sense of apprehending the text as when I simply chance upon a book in the library and then find associations that I didn't expect. And I want to retain that independence, and I think it's important that we remain responsible for that.
All right. Thank you very much for your questions.
Thank you very much.
Join us for our reception, which is just in the lobby, and have a glass of wine, and meet our speaker. Thank you.